Chapter 8. Armbruster found his challenge. He sped through the sectors at a pace that Moggs and Tauros could not hope to match, the spindly machine light on its feet thanks to his expert touch at the controls. The key was to allow the mech some leeway, not to be afraid of it, not to try and force it. Just go along for the ride, giving a gentle nudge in the right direction every now and again. He gave himself a generous estimate and was confident that he was hours ahead of his quarry now. They had to come this way, so he didn't have to waste time tracking them. Armbruster had time to play. The traitor approached a mobile fortress with confidence, one that had evidently defended the sector highway with great success. It sat, smoke pouring from multiple weapon barrels, armor pitted from hundreds of impacts, turrets swiveling to regard him as he strode straight at it. He didn't bother to open a channel to the huge war machine. Instead, Armbruster reached above him and flicked a switch, broadcasting a powerful, short-range identification tag, heavy with encryption that only another Loyalist unit would be able to decipher. The fortress kept its guns trained on him, but did not fire as he stomped past, his speed giving a sense of urgency to his movements. Just another Loyalist, cut off from his unit, desperate to regroup at District. That's what he was. That's what he looked like, as he scanned the hull of the fortress with a practiced eye, noting the extensive damage wreaked on the outer plating by what must have been an incredible amount of ordnance thrown at it. Armbruster figured the shields were definitely down. He was beyond the thing now, taking in every inch of the exterior, thinking about the characteristics of the mighty engine. He knew that fortresses were slow to turn, and that their armor was weaker at the rear. He was a leg hunter, specifically equipped to destroy vehicles of a much greater tonnage, but even his railgun wouldn't be enough to take on a fortress with its shields up. The evidence suggested that the shields were not operational, but he could not be sure. Only one way to find out. Armbruster spun his hunter's body like a turret and snapped off a single shot without slowing, recoil rocking his command pit as the hypersonic slug crossed the distance quicker than human thought. There was no blue flash, no ripple of oil effect of a functional hard shield. The dense projectile smacked into an ammunition magazine with pinpoint precision, punching through with ease. At first, nothing happened. Then, after several seconds, Armbruster saw the muted flashes of secondary explosions. Jets of flame erupted from vents and weapon ports as the interior of the fortress suffered. A confined chain reaction of ammo cooking off ripped through the compartments in a maelstrom no crew member could hope to survive. As he rotated to face front, Armbruster liked to imagine the screams as the Loyalists burnt at their stations. Served them right for being too trusting in this most troubling time. But that wasn't the challenge. It met him head-on, at speed, and without warning, coming the other way. The hunter saw combat action of sorts as he approached and was curious. There was a heavy traffic jam. Vehicles clustered to get through the sector gate and had funneled themselves into a bottleneck as the various streets converged at the entrance. Horns honked, and raised voices could be heard through his audio feeds as the civilian exodus crawled along at the pace of a sump slug. Light wickered fitfully from the left, thrown against the concrete of the sector dividing wall. The out-of-sight explosion caught Hugh's attention. Some distance away, a civilian car was propelled into the air against a backdrop of flame, and something fast skimmed into view as the boom of sound reached him. One, then another, then a third vehicle sped along, following the course of the perimeter wall, chased by tracer fire. They were A-Gravs of a kind, though much sleeker and efficient-looking than anything the army had ever produced, painted the colour of dry blood, and moving like nothing Armbruster had ever seen. They were firing into the densely packed traffic, chased by a group of Corvid scrap mechs, heavy machine guns blazing away, uselessly converting ammo into brass. The trio of war machines strafed and swirled through the air, deftly avoiding the incoming rounds, whilst picking their shots at the crowded civilians with admirable precision. It was almost leisurely, the way they went about their murder. Armbruster had to shake his head to avoid being mesmerized by the alien things. He saw it in the way they moved, the way they ignored the threats with utter disdain as they gleefully murdered screaming civilians, who were by now climbing over each other in their attempts to escape. They were kindred spirits, true warriors amongst this rabble of peasants and desk soldiers. A broad smile smeared itself across Armbruster's face as he checked the plate integrity and power levels of his railgun. They were good. He simply had to kill them. Second squad, I've got visual and fast movers left flank. Anna Morante's speech was clipped, tension evident in her voice. Numbers? Blake asked. Kinney was on the left of his squad, taking a break from dragging Bader. He caught sight of bikes and infantry moving along, a few streets down from the platoon's position. They were being flanked. Hard to tell, Morante replied. I'd say they outnumber us, though, bikes and dismounts, and at least one gun truck. They're paralleling us. Roger that, said the captain. Has anyone else got an idea about numbers? Kinney was going to respond when the sound of 8mm machine gun fire blazed out right in front of him. Contact left, Kronig reported flatly, the rapid fire of his weapon lighting up the block of apartments directly to their flank. Infantry in buildings with small arms, 50 yards. First on the trigger again, the sergeant obviously thought it wasn't worth talking about any longer as he started pumping 25mm rounds into windows in a methodical pattern. Each window got a double tap, bang bang, switch target, bang bang. With smoke and debris spewing from several buildings in reaction to the attack, Kinney passed an alleyway and stopped to scan for threats. As he did so, he made eye contact with a rider of an assault bike, sat stationary at the far end, engine idling. The man just sat there, goggles raised onto his forehead, creating rings of clean skin on a thin face otherwise caked in grime. He stared at Kinney, eyes narrow, full of hate, before gunning the throttle and he was gone. Don't slow down, fire on the move. The vehicles are trying to circle us, said the sergeant over the rattle of gunfire. The rest of the platoon joined in and they were suddenly in a game of cat and mouse, darting between side streets, trying to outmaneuver the highly mobile corvids that stalked them. Eddie and the Mogs equipped with 25mm guns sniped back and forth with the vehicles, snap-shooting at bikes and jury-rigged trucks on pure reflex. The much larger machine called out targets for the Mogs, while spears of coherent light lanced into those targets in rapid succession. The bully beam slowed the big trucks to make them easier targets, or in the case of bikes, melted them to the ground. Kinney, being armed with twin 8mm guns, engaged the closer targets within the buildings themselves. The incoming fire fizzled ineffectually from his shields, more an annoyance than a threat as they progressed to the next block. These guys were armed with no more than basic rifles and machine guns, and their fire was practically inconsequential. Even the unshielded Mogs were unharmed, such was the thickness of their plating. Hard rounds pinged and ricocheted from rolled steel armour, and the Separatists paid the price. Kinney swept both muzzles across a fixed MG position on the second story of an accommodation block, mounted at the front of a ruined storeroom. Reinforced by cement bags obviously stolen from a yard and piled up to form a makeshift fortification, the rebels clearly had high hopes for their improvised gun pit. The private watched as bags shredded under the assault, spilling their contents into the street. The pair of gunners spasmed and jerked as the FMG rounds ripped through them. Then they both slumped across the smoking weapon. Kinney did not stop to confirm his kills, merely giving a quick glance to his ammo counters and swept for targets. It was hard, firing on the move. He could barely see the enemy in the darkened rooms until they lit themselves up. Each burst of corvid fire was like a beacon, and Kinney was simply engaging muzzle flashes. The targeting reticules were not the most accurate aiming tools at the best of times. Kinney had to walk his rounds on target using his tracer as reference, a technique usually frowned upon in training for its wasteful nature. But training isn't combat, he thought to himself as he focused on the wildly shaking white targeters. He saw Kronig calmly firing single shots on the move as though it was a day at the range. A gun truck went up with a shot through the fuel tank. The improvised turret on the bed of the truck flew straight up, cartwheeling through the air, its helpless gunner kicking at nothing, unaware that he was already dead. Markovich whooped over the net from up ahead, and the wreckage of a bike came skidding out of a side street, missing a wheel. It came to a stop just in front of Eddie, who kicked the machine with full force. Kinney expected it to sail through the air and crash into a high-rise, then perhaps explode in a fireball, but it didn't. The entire structure of the bike just disintegrated with a sad crump, its component parts flung like confetti.
Whoa, did you see that?
Markovich yelled over the squad net. On your left, Morante stated, before the pair of them opened up on a bold truck that was barreling down the same side street. Hundreds of holes appeared in its framework within a couple of seconds. The windscreen smashed, but the crew was hunkered behind the dash, driving blind. The truck smashed straight into Markovich, who simply braced himself. A great screech married a smash as metal collided, and the truck crumpled all the way up to its crew compartment as the jovial trooper put his shoulder into it, driving the engine block into the crew members and pinning their legs. Markovich skidded back along the ground, carving deep gouges in the concrete with clawed toes until the truck had run out of momentum, then stuck his gun arms through the opening of the windshield. The truck crew burst like blood-filled water balloons under automatic fire, coating the hardy Mog in a sheet of gore. The bus saw report of his weapons chopped clean through the truck's bodywork and into a group of infantry that were following behind.
Yes! Have that, you bastards!
Morante added to the carnage, who was walking her rounds through the dismounts. They had hugged the walls to allow the truck to pass, and unwisely still hugged them for cover now. Tracer rounds ricocheted all down the narrow street. Some hit the brick wall and skipped along, smacking into the infantry that took cover there. The combined assault from two Mogs firing chopped the unfortunate separatists into mints in short order, and second squad was soon cheering over the net. Kinney returned his attention to the next side street left of his own position. A front wheel, light glinting from a lightly armoured chassis, those same eyes again, filled with hate. Except this time the bike was facing him, and he stared down the barrel of a 25mm anti-material gun.
"Sergeant, bike!"
he reported, words lost to the noise as both he and the separatist fired simultaneously. MGs rattled, shell casings spewed from ejection ports, and the vibration pushed up Kinney's arms into his shoulders once again. He was firing blind, his vision whited out as a direct hit cannoned into his Mog. The shields took the hit, then popped with their characteristic sound that advertised to all and sundry that their target was now unprotected. Kinney was assailed by a wash of ozone, followed by another 25mm AP round that he never saw. The round punched through armour, bored a hole straight through flesh and expended its energy, forcing superheated spalling from an exit wound of the Mog that pattered against Kinney's armour. He heard the clang of fire against bare armour, and as Kinney's vision cleared, he saw the outline of a burnt Mog and let go of his triggers. Oh no. In Kinney's periphery, Sergeant Kronig advanced on the attack bike, firing a rocket salvo that erased it from existence in short order before resuming his advance. The young private looked at the blackened chassis stood in front of him, saw the bare-edged metal of the exit wound contrasting with the charred exterior, and tried to catch Bader as he fell. It was a clumsy effort, doomed to fail. Kinney couldn't get a grip, the relatively stumpy gauntlet of his suit unable to pass the barrels of his guns. As a result, armoured hands slipped on the Mog's power pack, feeling the heat of the exhaust as it pushed him back, and Bader crashed to a heap at his feet. Unable to form words, Kinney simply scrambled, manoeuvring the best he could to try and reach the emergency eject cord once again.
"Leave him!" Kronig growled over the net. "He's dead."
Kinney ignored him and grit his teeth, getting a handhold of the melted lever. With a momentous strain that St. Martin would have been proud of, he tugged on the lever from his precarious position. One machine stooped over another and immediately wished he hadn't. The cockpit plating punched open on hydraulic rams, revealing the carnage within. Bader's face was twisted in a desperate snarl, eyes wide with the supreme effort of a mortally wounded man protecting his friend. His legs were still strapped in place, but there was nothing of him from upper chest to waist, and his upper remains collapsed into his own lap as the remnants of his harness detached. Kinney tried not to gag inside his suit. Suddenly he was yanked to the side by a weapon arm, and Kronig kicked his Mog in the back, causing him to stumble forward.
"I told you, boy, he's dead! Now move!"
Kinney choked down bile as he attempted to move his legs. Tears streamed down his face. His legs felt like they were made of concrete. They just didn't want to go anywhere.
"Don't be dead weight, trooper,"
Kronig said as he shoved past, opening up again on distant targets with controlled bursts.
How can you be so cold?
Kinney asked quietly, his voice shaking without malice. The sergeant did not hesitate.
Imagine the friends I've lost.
And he was gone again, barking orders up and down the line.
It wasn't supposed to be like this.
They were meant to get Bader some medical help. Even if he was doomed, they could have at least made him comfortable. Maybe he figured out that he was on borrowed time, Kinney thought, and decided to die doing something heroic instead. He half heard Captain Blake issuing instructions over the net. Kronig reported the death of Bader. Heroic, he spat out loud to himself. There was nothing heroic about dying for a cause you had no faith in.
But it was the Corvids that killed him, not the MPA. Everyone on Novo Solo had to complete their mandatory 2 years of service. Everybody knew this, so they all knew that they would be fighting brothers, sisters, daughters, and sons. And they're killing them anyway.
Kinney shook, tears streaming down his face. It didn't make any sense. If they'd just negotiated, half the damn army would have downed tools and quit on the spot. So many lives could have been saved, instead of forcing the soldiers to defend themselves. Reynolf took a moment, stopping his stomach that threatened to coat the inside of his cockpit, and set his jaw. His political views were meaningless now. He had their blood on his hands, and the Corvids would kill him regardless. Kinney shook his head, accompanied by an incomprehensible yell of frustration, and followed his sergeant. Captain Blake played her bully beam across a group of infantry that had broken cover at her advance. Intimidated by Eddie's obvious power, they were scurrying to the next hardpoint they could see. The slowest members were superheated so fast that they disintegrated into smouldering swirls of dust, weapons glowing white-hot, clattering to the ground. Blake tracked the remainder as they leapt into the ground floor of yet another bombed-out accommodation block and followed them in.
How dare they, she thought, full of righteous fury. How dare they stab the system in the back? The system that supports their very existence. How dare they turn my own men against me?
And all it took was a stupid contract from a corporation that nobody had ever seen. Eddie bull-rushed into the ruined building, bringing the ceiling down upon the Corvid infantry, burying them in plaster and concrete. Several grotty forms crawled from the mess, coughing and spluttering, wild eyes darting back and forth as they desperately searched for fallen weapons. Blake melted them to the floor. Clouds of brick dust diffused the beam enough so that the air itself inside the building caught fire, bathing Eddie in a short-lived breath of flame, making it appear as though the machine was a dragon from legend.
Thurman!
Behind her, the undisciplined crackle of intermittent rifle fire competed with the chatter of twin 8mm, interspersed with the occasional crump of low-level artillery detonating. It was nothing her QRF platoon couldn't handle, though ammo expenditure was definitely an issue. She asked for updates, and calculated that there should be enough, as long as a tank battalion didn't come rolling round the corner. Blake spun Eddie's torso and stepped back, careful not to tread on any of her troopers, before rounding the corner of the block. The agricultural facility was to her 10 o'clock. Over the tops of smaller buildings she could just make out the shattered roofs of enormous greenhouses, edged by artificial crop fields that ran for miles, following the line of district. The facility and its fields provided vital sustenance for dozens of sectors, including Blake's own. They were riddled with craters, entire crops ruined by indiscriminate shellfire. People will be eating fungus and rats this winter, the captain thought absently. Infantry and what appeared to be Junker Mogs scrambled among the churned muck, attempting their own attack against District HQ. The flank was meant to be uncontested. No matter, that was their way in. All call signs, do not stop. We're approximately 1 mile out from the eastern entrance. We will approach in extended line. First squad to my left, second to the right. All call signs confirm. She got a pair of breathless responses from her squad leaders, accompanied by the whine of servos and clanging of small arms fire against unshielded mugs. It sounded like heavy hail against a tin roof.
What's the status on our wounded? Is he still moving?
Negative, Kronig reported. Bader is KIA, AP round.
Damn it, she said to herself. But then, Bader's death would speed them up somewhat and allow all legs to focus on the mission. She cursed herself for the thought, but maybe he would help them more in death than he could have had he continued to cling to life. "Roger that," she responded to the sergeant. "Continue to make best speed. We're nearly there, people." Eddie's generator screamed, and as the massive machine cleared the last street of the habitation area, lumps of masonry shaking loose from the carapace with every step, Blake surged forwards once more.